Judge Lefko of the Northern District of Illinois sitting with us, helping us with our work. Our first case for argument, United States v. Johnson and Lamb. Mr. Scott? Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Rowe.
Okay.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Along with my colleague John Scott, under 7-Eleven licenses with the Northwestern University Bloom Legal Clinic, we represent appellant Lisa Lamb. And we ask that this Court reverse Ms. Lamb's conviction, or at a minimum, remand for resentencing. The first reason to reverse is that Congress never intended this statute, Section 1512C1, a Sarbanes-Oxley provision, to cover Lamb's alleged conduct. Rather, the government seemingly shoehorns Lamb into 1512C1 in an attempt to threaten her with a 20-year maximum sentence instead of a much lighter sentence under statutory alternatives. Under the government's reading of this statute,
should she have been charged with, assuming she destroyed the drugs in order to, you know, avoid either her being prosecuted or Johnson, what would be the proper statute?
Your Honor, there are a number of alternatives. At a minimum, there is a statute, Section 1519, that deals with obstruction of an investigation. There is 18 U.S.C. Section 2232, which deals with obstruction of a search warrant. And, of course, there are sentencing enhancements that have previously dealt with the obstruction of justice, for example, a possession charge. Under the government's reading of this statute, though, every drug case could now be a violation of the Sarbanes-Oxley statute. And we have a number of clues that Congress...
Not every drug case.
Certainly every drug case where there is the possibility of the destruction
of
contraband.
Not the possibility. Every drug case in which drugs were destroyed in order to avoid, in order to obstruct the investigation.
Your Honor, it would be obstruction of an official proceeding, and in those circumstances, the Sarbanes-Oxley statute would be implicated in the hypothetical that you give.
Someone driving and throw drugs out the window, would that be applicable?
I do not believe that would meet the requirements.
Would it be similar, though?
I think
to what we have here.
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the hypothetical that
I'm not asking this to challenge it. I'm just asking you, in that case, if just somebody get rid of the drugs because they don't want to be caught with it.
At most, that would be the obstruction of an investigation, not an official proceeding.
So what do you think object means in the statute?
Well, the text certainly gives us a couple of clues. For example, the justum generis provides that the residual...
Give me an example of an object that's within the scope of the statute. There is the word object.
Other objects.
I want to give some force, some meaning to it. So what would be an example?
It could be a diskette. It could be...
No, that's a record, right? That has information on it. Something that isn't a record or a document. That's what I'm interested in.
Well, Your Honor, I think diskette would fall under other objects.
No, a diskette is a record, right? It has material in it. It has information. That's a record.
I believe Congress, by enumerating record and document, and then the residual phrase
of... Give me an example of object, which is not a record.
I believe a diskette or files in a file cabinet...
No, because a diskette or a file contains information. It's a record.
We believe that the reading of other object, though, is confined by those...
Give me an example of an object that is not a record.
What about a gun such as Matthews?
Matthews certainly construes objects beyond the most faithful reading of the statute, but there's a couple of differences in Matthews, certainly the first being that that object wasn't contraband in the hands of the defendant in that case. Moreover...
What difference does that make?
Well, for example, to shoehorn contraband into 1512C1, that would require...
Well, if you're destroying contraband, that's a standard way of obstructing investigation.
But the 1512C1 specifically provides for official proceeding.
If you let the gun in, you've got to let the drugs in.
But one, I would say 1512C1 specifically discusses an official proceeding, not the obstruction of an investigation. But contraband is different than a gun in that the government's reading of the statute would require somebody in possession of contraband to continue possessing that contraband to avoid an obstruction of justice charge. That's an absurd result that courts have.
It's not an absurd result. Why is that an absurd result? I'm not saying the person has to keep ingesting the drug. The point is, if there's an investigation, a search warrant, police trying to break in, you don't suddenly decide, well, contraband is a terrible thing, so I'm going to destroy it. You should let the police get it for their investigation. That's a terrible argument.
But in the context of this statute that requires official proceeding, which is the term of art.
I'm talking about your really silly argument in your brief that somehow if a person doesn't destroy contraband, he's doing a bad thing, because whenever you see contraband, you should destroy it. That's a very bad argument.
Be that as it may, the second difference with Matthews, of course, is that in Matthews, the object was temporally connected to an official proceeding that Congress never envisioned in the immediacy of a search warrant. In Matthews, we had an 11-week investigation. Matthews himself had met with the FBI and met with ICE agents, and more importantly, an official proceeding was already well underway.
He said but, at the outset now, Matthews said at the outset, the gun is the whole deal, right? And he's got to hide the gun. He's got to keep it away from it. So look out for Dave, as he put it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right, now, you're distinguishing that, whatever you want to call it, 11-week investigation to this 20-minute search trying to get in the house when, what's her name, Lamb?
Correct.
Was doing something. So I'd want you to distinguish those cases if you're...
Matthews and Lamb, again, I would point to the difference in the connection between the object and a temporal official proceeding.
That doesn't make any sense. Look, what the statute says, our statute says, is intend to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, right? Now, the police, you know, with their search warrant, they want this stuff. They want the drugs for use in an official proceeding, namely a prosecution of Johnson. So what she does, by destroying the object, she impairs and intends to impair the object's availability for use in an official proceeding.
At most, Lamb could have had knowledge of an investigation at the point in time at which...
Investigations lead to prosecutions when you are in possession of a large amount of drugs. She doesn't care about the search. She cares about either herself or Johnson's being prosecuted.
The premise of the hypothetical isn't true even in this case, because we know Dave Johnson was in the house with Lisa Lamb. At most, he had knowledge of an investigation, but he was never arrested, could never have foreseen an official proceeding.
Knowledge of an investigation. Police are banging at the door. You, Lamb, you're sitting on a large quantity of drugs, so you immediately try to destroy them in order to prevent their being used to prosecute somebody, yourself, your friend, what have you.
Your Honor, I see I'm running into my rebuttal time. I again would suggest that the difference between an official proceeding and investigation is much different. We have two statutory schemes that deal with those two things.
Look, it's for use in an official proceeding. The official proceeding is anticipated. It is the consequence of a search that turns up substantial amounts of drugs is the prelude to an official proceeding. And if you try to destroy that contraband, your intent is to impair the availability of that contraband for use in the official proceeding, namely the prosecution.
Again, I can only suggest that an investigation is different than an official proceeding.
Of course an investigation is different. The point is, the reason you want to destroy this stuff, it's not because you care about an investigation. You care about what the investigation leads to, which is the prosecution and is an official proceeding.
Your point is taken, Honor. I would ask, with only a minute left, that I reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Mr. Boyce?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Don Boyce here this morning on behalf of the government. Lisa Lamb was convicted of one count of obstruction of justice at trial under 1512C1. The trial evidence showed generally that Lamb had knowledge of her boyfriend Johnson's drug dealing because she was there when he picked up drugs, when drugs were delivered, and when he sold drugs.
Why was she initially charged with participation in a conspiracy and then it was dropped?
Well, Your Honor, there was additional evidence initially, and then on the eve of trial, two witnesses refused to testify, so we went forward with our best case.
That's the best case, then, huh?
It was the best case we had on the eve of trial, Your Honor, yes.
Well, maybe I'd ask the other. You use Matthew's case. There's a precedent. You use
yes,
Matthew's
Your Honor.
Case. And, at least to me, there seems to be a huge distinction there. Matthew's, you mentioned 11-week, long time, where there's a lot of going on, and the first thing he does is realize that gun is the whole key to their case. And so he's doing everything he can to hide it. He knows, he's chief of police. There's no doubt he knows where it's going. He knows there's going to be trials, et cetera, going on if this is exposed. That's why he hides it from everybody, from ICE, the FBI, everybody else. Here we have 20-minute attempt to enter the house.
Judge.
How is she anticipating something going on compared to Matthew?
Well, that goes right to the foreseeability requirement. Because there is not a requirement under this statute that an official proceeding be pending, it must be foreseeable. So the reason that Lamb knows it's foreseeable is, well, first of all, she knows her boyfriend's a drug dealer because she's come to Rockford to pick up drugs with him. She's been at the house in East St. Louis when the drugs are delivered, and she's been there when he's selling drugs. Now, on top of that, the police are at the door. Agent Ray says, I'm Agent Ray from the DEA. I have a search warrant. When she says, can I see it? He says, well, I'll get it, but you have to at least stand here so I can see you for my safety and so you don't destroy evidence. Instead, she slams the door on him, and they spend 20 to 30 minutes trying to saw the iron gate off the door. Basically, Judge, when the police are at the door with the search warrant, wanting to enter the house to search.
She's trying to destroy the stuff. Now, isn't that a concern about being caught with possession?
Well, and knowing that that's going to lead to something down the road.
But she's looking at her watch. It seems to me the whole focus here is possession. Was she charged with possession?
No, Your Honor. She was just charged with the obstruction of justice.
Well, they did find, 150 grams on this.
It was the residue on the Pyrex dish that she was trying to wash off.
Didn't
in the
they find 150 grams at Westmoreland?
I don't think that there was any other drugs left at Westmoreland.
It was all gone?
Right.
Okay, I thought there was still some there.
There was some other items of evidence, packaging,
where,
and scales.
Where did they find the total of 300 grams? Or whatever?
They had done a controlled buy of cocaine from Westmoreland before the search warrant, before applying for it. Then they got, after the controlled buy, they stopped another car leaving Westmoreland and got some more cocaine out of that. So that was cocaine leaving Westmoreland before the execution of the search warrant. By the time they got in there, there was less evidence available than there may have been before.
Johnson supposedly confessed to 7 kilograms, was it? That he sold the night before?
He said he had gotten in 7 kilos and had sold most of it already.
Sold it, and they found some money.
Yes, he had $16,000 on him when he was arrested. And there was some money at the restaurant, too, but I believe we gave that back as we agreed with them that that was money that the restaurant may have made.
Fish.
Yes.
Well, okay.
Mr. Rowe suggested that there are other statutes under which he could be prosecuted that would be more sort of focused on this kind of behavior than the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Is he correct?
Well, Your Honor, I can tell you that I certainly looked through the code in charging the case and picked the one that I thought fit most clearly. And, of course, the fact that your conduct may violate more than one statute.
I understand. I just wondered if there was another statute that she could have been charged under for obstruction.
Well, I guess that's subject to interpretation. I'll say that my interpretation was I couldn't find a better one.
Well, you didn't find a case closer than Matthews, did you?
That was the one we relied on, Your Honor. Most centrally. That was the one we got the jury instructions from.
We're going to have to stretch that law some more with this, aren't we?
I don't think you're stretching the law. I think that the law is already that 1512C applies if the proceeding is foreseeable. And based on these facts, when the police are at the door demanding entry in order to seize evidence, mm-hmm. foreseeable
they're going to get you possessing something.
Well, unless you have knowledge that your boyfriend's been is a multi-kilo level
part
of
the conspiracy. That
right.
Might have worked. I guess you lost a couple of witnesses for that.
We did, Your Honor. And we considered proceeding on the conspiracy without those witnesses, but decided to go forward with what we felt was our best case.
Well, Mr. Rose is talking about obstructing investigation. Why didn't this case fit into that?
I don't know the elements off that off the top of my head, but this was the one. This is the case that fit best.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a rule of construction that criminal law should be narrowly construed, and it does seem that this Sarbanes-Oxley, they probably weren't thinking about destroying drugs when Congress enacted the law.
They may not have been. The law says records, documents, other objects. You know, drug dealers do sometimes keep records and documents. It's certainly conceivable that those terms could apply in a drug case. Mm-hmm. But as a practical matter, when Congress enacts a law, they don't say, unless they tell you in the law, they don't say you can only use this in white-collar cases. Mm-hmm. The law is what it says, and if you violate what it says in the law, then you can be prosecuted. Now, as to construing things narrowly, the fact that a term can be construed broadly doesn't make it ambiguous. I think you have to construe a statute narrowly if you can't understand what it says, but I would submit that there's really nothing ambiguous about the term object. It's a clear, common-sense term, and we can all understand what it means. Therefore, we don't need to look behind it for Congress's reasoning or the canons of construction and so on.
Would this, with any drug case, would where people are dealing drugs, selling them, shipping them around, or conspiring, everything else, they don't like getting caught with them. So is this going to be applicable to almost every drug case where...
Well, no, there's the corrupt...
Except there's the exception where either didn't have time or even attempting to get rid of it, they didn't succeed. When is this not going to apply to a...
When the purpose of destroying the drugs is not to keep them from being presented at an official proceeding, and when you don't have the corrupt motive...
How often are drug cases involved where there's some attempt to... I use throwing out the window or to hide it or to, you know, hide it in furnace, all sorts of things about what can be labeled obstructing in a drug case.
Well, I can't tell you what percentage of conduct out there includes obstructive conduct in drug cases. I can tell you that the statute requires a corrupt motive, which is the purpose of wrongfully impeding the due administration of justice. So if you take the situation of someone who has some drugs and just wants to get rid of them, you're not impeding the due administration of justice. You don't have any idea that, you know, basically, if the police aren't at the door trying to get the drugs, or if you're not already indicted or something like that, you know, you can just get rid of drugs. That's not in violation of the statute. The statute itself has limits.
Why do you want to get rid of the drugs?
Well, the Lamb's camp seems to think that you may just want to get rid of drugs and that the statute would criminalize any attempt to do so. The statute's limits are in there. It has the corrupt motive. You have to have a corrupt state of mind. And of the proceeding that you're obstructing has to be foreseeable. So those things that are right in the statute put the limits on it.
If you get caught with drugs, isn't something foreseeable?
If you get caught with drugs, sure.
Well, that's why they destroy them, so you don't get caught.
Well, you could destroy them because you decided you didn't want to be a drug addict anymore, right?
That's another possible reason to destroy drugs.
I don't know. Sometimes you see, the woman in Lamb's situation says, I don't like my boyfriend selling drugs out of my house, so I'm going to get rid of them. You know, there are reasons.
Maybe that's what she was doing.
I don't think the evidence supports that interpretation in this case, Judge.
And what about Dave? Why does Dave come and go at will, and he's there the whole time and seems to get totally off the hook?
Well, the evidence against Dave was that the agent saw Dave when he went to the door, that Dave moved to the front of the house, that there was no more contact with Dave until they got in there.
Maybe he was flushing the toilet or something.
Dave may have been flushing the toilet. I think we would have run pretty squarely into a mere presence argument had we tried to charge Dave with something. Frankly, it didn't look like there was enough evidence to charge Dave with anything, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Boyd.
You.
Mr. Rowe? Mr. Rowe, Mr. Scott. So suppose you had a Sarbanes-Oxley charge of some sort, I don't really know the details of Sarbanes-Oxley, but suppose you had a CEO and he had received a Rolex watch from a customer, and it really should have been corporate property, or she reported to the board, you know, they'd gotten this present, but he didn't. And investigation begins, and he destroys the Rolex to obstruct the investigation. Now, would that be the kind of object destruction that would violate the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I believe
that... Answer yes or no, and then it can explain your answer.
I would say possibly.
That's not an answer.
Yes, Your Honor, but only
if... So what is the answer?
The answer is yes.
Okay,
but only
now you can
if,
qualify it. Okay, and what's the only if?
But only if the official proceeding was foreseeable as 1512C...
Okay, foreseeable, fine.
See,
accept that, okay. If it's foreseeable, fine. Now, do you think the statute is limited to white-collar crime?
We believe that the statute as written was intended to be limited
That's
to white-collar
my
crime.
Why don't you answer my question? Do you think this statute is limited to
yes,
white-collar crime?
Yes, Your Honor.
And where in the statute does it say that it's limited to white-collar crime?
The statute as written, Sarbanes-Oxley, was intended and written in the context of addressing corporate fraud.
It doesn't say it's just for white. It doesn't say that every provision of this act is limited to white-collar crime. We don't want to soil this act by having it applied to sordid drug transactions.
That is correct, Your Honor. But we would argue that under this particular set of facts, there are alternative statutes, namely 2232, and potentially a cross-reference.
What about subsection D, where it says, whoever intentionally harasses another person, et cetera, from attending or testifying in an official proceeding. Is that also limited to white-collar crimes?
We would argue that because the records...
Yes no.
Possibly not. I'm not
no,
as familiar...
Yes or no? Yes or no? Is it limited to white-collar crimes?
Yes, but...
Well, that's ridiculous, because it doesn't say anywhere in there, right? You can't do that to a statute. What white-collar crimes? Crimes committed by, what, CEOs? Or What if a janitor in Facebook steals a laptop, is that a white-collar crime or to which this statute would be applicable?
Your Honor, I see that may I?
Look, if I ask you a question, I expect an answer. So why do you say, why do you ask for my permission to answer? I ask you a question. Would I ask you a question intending that you not be able to answer because the red light had gone on? Wouldn't that be rather sadistic? So in that case, would this statute be applicable?
This statute could be applicable to those situations.
Would it be applicable in my hypothetical case, the janitor who steals the laptop from Facebook?
Without an official proceeding pending, no.
No, there's an official proceeding. He knows that if he's caught, he's going to be prosecuted.
If there's an official proceeding pending, then yes, the destruction of the computer would be.
Pending, surely.
Well,
what does it mean, pending?
Well, the statute, the foreseeability...
Suppose it's impending. Suppose it's been announced that there will be an investigation of this theft and that whoever is caught will be prosecuted. Suppose that's been announced by...
We would argue...
Zuckerberg himself.
Under that factual situation, the more applicable statute would be 1519, Your Honor.
That's not my question. Is this statute inapplicable in my hypothetical case? I don't care what other statutes
are. Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Why is it inapplicable?
It's inapplicable because...
It's a white-collar crime, theft.
It's inapplicable because...
Not violent.
Because the foreseeability as conceived under this statute requires more than mere understanding of an investigation is currently underway. It requires that a defendant be, that the proceeding be much closer in time, and we know this because of the existence of alternative statutes, namely 1519 and 20.
Okay, whoever intentionally dissuades any person from attending or testifying in an official proceeding. So suppose this person who's stolen, he's been seen to steal the laptop. So he goes to another person and says, look, if this ever leads to a prosecution, will you please not testify in it? Now, wouldn't that be attempting to dissuade a person from...
Yes, Your Honor.
So the statute would be applicable in that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have anything further? I don't want to...
I do.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. And I'm back to the Matthews case. When they pretty much acknowledged that this is sort of a fallback because they didn't get some witnesses on the conspiracy, which would have seemed to be pretty appropriate given the fact she had knowledge and his whatever she's doing there to facilitate the stash house and that sort of thing. But at this juncture, what was foreseeable to her during this attempted entry and what she was doing? What would you say was foreseeable? Because you say she wouldn't, if a grand jury isn't foreseeable, what is?
At the most, Your Honor, it would be the service of a warrant. The officer said that they had a warrant. They didn't actually have the physical copy at that time. And at
okay,
most...
Well, so they serve a warrant, okay?
Correct.
That isn't... They're not going to go home. So, okay.
No, Your Honor.
What's foreseeable beyond serving a warrant? She knows once they get in, something's going to happen.
Correct. And she knew that they were serving a warrant and that she could potentially infer that there was an investigation going on. But there are two statutes which deal very specifically with that conduct. And... namely 2232 and 1519. 2232 in particular carries a much lighter sentence than either the Sarbanes-Oxley statute.
What's that say?
Say again? I'm sorry.
What does that statute say?
The 2232 deals with the obstruction or destruction of objects in an attempt to prohibit the service of a warrant.
Okay, so...
Why do you say that it's not an official proceeding? Because... the agent goes before a judge, and the judge, the case has a number then. It has, if it's federal court, it has an M number, and it's an investigation, and it's also an official proceeding.
Your Honor, in Matthews, the court discussed the nature of the official proceeding and stated that it needed to be a grand jury investigation or a proceeding in front of the district court, namely a trial. We would argue that that's bolstered by the fact that there's an alternative statute which deals with investigations, which would be the step that precedes those official proceedings. Now, not all investigations lead to official proceedings, and not all warrants lead to ongoing investigations. So we would argue that Congress was very deliberate in creating three different statutory schemes in which to address conduct at different stages of the prosecution.
What was the other statute you mentioned besides 2232?
1519, Your Honor.
So are you suggesting that if there are three overlapping statutes, the government has to choose the one that has the lightest sentence?
Your Honor, we're arguing that the government needs to choose...
No.
No, but we're arguing that the government needs to choose the statute that applies to the conduct. And in this
particular... Obviously, yes. That's my question, is if you have three statutes applying to the same conduct, does the government have to pick the one with the lightest penalties?
No, Your Honor.
Would they have to pick the one with the most direct conduct?
We would argue that they would have to pick the one that is most applicable to the conduct, as narrowly as
possible. Applicable, even if they're all applicable?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Rowe and Mrs. Scott and Northwestern, for your excellent efforts on behalf of your client. We'll move on to our next case.